Parshas Vayechi, and really Erev the Asar B'Teves, Tafshin Ayin Aleph. Now we will, God willing, link both the ideas of Asar B'Teves, today the 9th of Teves, yesterday the 8th of Teves, okay, and Yaakov's bracha specifically to Dan today in our talk. And we're going to start with what we ended with last week. Because Asar B'Teves is the day, as we know from Yechezkel, that the king of Bavel surrounded, besieged Yerushalayim in the end of the first temple. Okay? And that day became forever a tzom, a fast day. And as you notice, since it falls out on Friday, which is very odd, and the last time it happened was 2001, you notice that it must be a very significant fast day if Chazal, figured out the calendar forever and ensured by the way they set things up that certain fasts will never fall on certain days and certain Yom Tovim will never fall on certain days. They allowed the Asar B'Teves to fall on a Friday, which they don't allow for other fasts. And we don't push it off like we would if it was Tanis Esther or something else. And we actually fast on a Friday, breaking the fast by Kiddush. Okay? And Chazal do not push off this fast. It's a very significant fast. It's not a light fast. It's up there with Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, the Asar B'Teves. And our job is to figure out why it's so important. It's not even Shavuos or Batamas, where they actually breach the walls of the city. It's not even Tisha B'Av, where they burn the Beis HaMikdash, which really happened actually the next day. And yet, it's so significant that Chazal set it up that you can fast on a Friday. Okay? So the question is the significance of Asar B'Teves, and, of course, its position in light of not just the 10th of Teves, but its proximity to the 9th of Teves and the 8th of Teves. Now, as we said, we're going to start with what we ended with last week. The 10th of Teves is clearly the beginning of what led to the Gullus, the siege around Jerusalem, right? That led to the next phases, which led to the Gullus. This Gullus, this final Gullus, is compared to a pit. Okay, pits are very significant in these last parshios. Yosef was thrown into a pit. There are parallels between how Yosef's pit is described and how this last Gullus is described as being a pit, because as you know, regarding Yosef, when he was thrown into a pit, the Torah says that they threw him in, v'habor reik, and the pit was empty, ein bo mayim, there was no water. So Chazal say there was no water, but it was filled with snakes and scorpions. There were nechashim and akravim, and snakes and scorpions. Now the word nechash is very important, and akrav is very important. They obviously signify things. Now here, all these ideas, by the way, today that we are going to be talking about come from two different pieces from Rav Moshe Shapiro, who lays this whole, he opens up, like pulls away the veil, opens up windows here into Asar B'Teves, the 8th, the 9th, and Teves. He's going to talk about Dan. He's going to talk about the last Gullus. He's going to talk about Yishmol, which we're not going to spend so much time on. Two pieces. One is about the 10th of Teves. It was Vayigash of 5770. And one was Vayigash of 5769. Okay? So, first of all, of snakes and scorpions, he brings down here the following, that the Zohar says the fourth exile under the kingdom of Edom is called a pit. But what kind of pit? It's referred to as a pit into which an ox fell. Now, who's the ox? Who's the Bahar Shar? Yosef. So, here's the connection. In the Pasuk in Shemos Perek Chaf Aleph, it says, Ki yichre ishbor, if a person digs a pit, v'lo yichaseno, and he doesn't cover it, v'nafal sham ashor, and a shor falls into it. This is a reference to the last gullus, which is like a pit that Yosef, like the shor, falls into. And remember, when Yosef the shor fell into a pit, it was full of snakes and scorpions. So these are the illusions. Now, none of this is on the surface. On the surface, the Torah, and we're going to speak about this. On the surface, the Torah is describing torts and damages. You open a pit, you don't cover it, somebody's ox falls into it, you're liable. But beneath the surface, what the deeper levels of Torah are telling us, that there's something called a pit, and when an ox falls in a pit, that's a reference to Yosef, and that's a reference to the last gullus, then you should be aware that if there's no water in the pit, then inevitably the snakes and the scorpions are going to find a place to live there. It's either water, which they don't live in, or snakes and scorpions. Those are your two options for the last gullus. And if there's no water, there's going to be snakes and scorpions. That's the inevitability. Nature abhors a vacuum. So if it's an empty pit, what you're going to find are snakes and scorpions. Okay, now, so the last gullus, let's put a few things together. The last gullus is a pit. It associates with Yosef. Yosef, we know, we've spoke about it, is from Rachel. The fact that Yaakov was grooming Yosef for Malchus means that the whole concept of Yosef is Klal Yisrael having direction in the gullus. Yosef and the Bnei Rachel always represent the leaders of Klal Yisrael in the gullus. Examples, Yosef and Mitzrayim. Okay, it's Yoshua from Rachel that leads Klal Yisrael into Eretz Yisrael and captures it for them. Okay, it's Esther and Mordechai from Binyamin. It's Shaul preceding David. It's always Bnei Rachel that set things up prior to the real establishment of the Jewish people's commonwealth sovereignty in Eretz Yisrael, at which case Malchus Beis David takes over. Okay, so when we're talking about a pit and Yosef in the pit, we're talking about gullus. That's clear. We're talking about gullus and the direction we need in gullus. And the first information we're getting, as we said, is if there's no mayim, and what is mayim always, a metaphor for? There's no mayim, there's going to be nechashim and akravim, snakes, and scorpions. Okay, let's take it further. Snakes, nechashim, that shorish of the word nechash we mentioned last week is chush, send your senses, your feelings, your temptations. That is nachash, chush, chushim. Okay, who was, by the way, who was named chushim? Chushim ben Dan. The bracha Yaakov gives to Dan is Dan yehi nachash ale derech. So there's a lot of Dan, nachash, the pit, the last gullus going together here. Dan is called a nachash. His son is chushim, and he represents the last gullus because now Dan is the Shevet that always represents the low point of Klal Yisrael, the dark side of Klal Yisrael, which we'll get to. But these are all ideas that are none of them clear, straight out, explained in essay form in the Pshat. They're all kind of like, kind of swirling around beneath the surface. Okay? So we have Nachash, which is Dan. We'll go through all of these. You can make two columns, okay? Asar B'teves, Dan, and you can make a third column, Septuagint, and we'll talk about that, and Greek knowledge. But anyway, now the other thing that was in the pit was Akravim. Just like Nachash has as its root push, temptations, feelings, so Akrav has an ayin, which is going to be significant, and it's the word Akrav, the shorish, other than the beis, is oker, to uproot, or ikar, essence. Now, here's the thing. There is a halacha, okay? The Mishnah says that if a person is davening and a nachash starts coiling itself around one's heel, one should not disrupt his prayer. The Gemara says here, the Talmud says here, this applies only to a nachash, but if a serpent starts to attack a person, they should disrupt their prayer. In fact, they must. Now, this is a separate halacha, talking about serpents and scorpions. It's clearly going to be related to what we're talking about. So a person is davening, and a nachash winds its way around their ankle. They ignore it. Nachash, we said, is chush, temptation, which means to say that if a person is standing before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, trying to devote their heart and their mind and their thoughts to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to try to attach themselves to feelings of devotion, devekus, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and temptations arise. And they start thinking about inappropriate things, or their regular human biological impulses, or any other type of emotional temptation. let it go, because a person may stand in front of a Kadosh Baruch Hu exposed for their humanity, for who they are with all their strengths and all their shortcomings. That's acceptable. But if a scorpion, something that is oker, uproots, rav, akrav, uproots what we've been taught by a rabbonim, in other words, Torah truths, that means apikarsis, a denial of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. You must deal with it, because you can't stand in front of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, and you're not standing in front of a Kadosh Baruch Hu at all. You're denying the truth, the validity that there even is a Kadosh Baruch Hu, or that you're subservient to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. That doesn't work. You can stand in front of a Kadosh Baruch Hu beset with weaknesses, with temptation, with challenges, but you can't stand in front of a Kadosh Baruch Hu not even sure if there is a Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's Nachash and Akrav. That's snake and scorpion. Okay? So the last galus is when a person means we're trying to daven, and the two things that are hindrances are our heart and our mind. The heart we can deal with, but the mind that denies the Torah, denies the truth, that's a problem. That you can't daven. Okay. So we started early today, by the way. Hopefully we'll be able to maintain it. Early being another word for kind of on time. Hopefully we'll be able to maintain this. But let's now set up what we've already kind of discussed. We're working with a lot of interesting ideas swirling beneath the surface, okay? We're working with, you can make, as I said, a chart with columns, the 10th of Teves, okay? Part of a three-day darkness period, the 8th, the 9th, and the 10th, okay? And the 10th of Teves, we said, is very significant. We can even fast on a Friday, which is very unusual, and the Chazal didn't let that really happen with any other fast days. Very rarely, except for 10th of Teves, and it's very significant, we said. And the halachic reason, by the way, for the significance of this is because the wording used in Yechezkel, Perek Chaf Dalid, Pasuk Beis, is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him, Kesav Lecha, write for you, as Shem Hayom, the name of this day, as Etzem Hayom Hazeh, the very, very exact essence of this day, because it was on this day, Samach Melech Bavel El Yerushalayim Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh. The king of Babylon besieged Yerushalayim on this very day. And since it talks about this very day, we fast on this very day, we don't push it off like we would do with many other holidays. Obviously, Teves is, Asar B'Teves is very significant. The only other Tanis that says that we use that phrase, Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh, is Yom Kippur. So although it's not Tisha B'Av and it's not Yom Kippur, don't think it's one of the lighter fasts. It's of the non-Yom Kippur Tisha B'Av light fasts, it's the most serious one. And Chazal want us to fast, even that you fast, as we said, and break your fast by Kiddush. Okay? So, what is Asar B'Teves? It's the beginning of the darkness. It's the beginning of the Golus, no question about it. But specifically, it's when Melech Bavel surrounded Yerushalayim, and the word is Samach. And somach is important. It's related to the word, like we say in Ashrei, somech Hashem l'chol hanoflim. Hashem supports, protects all those that fall. So although there's an impending calamity, the fact that the pasuk uses the word somach, that the king of Bavel surrounded, there's implied in that, that in the descent into Golus, in the calamity is also the protection, the support, somech Hashem l'chol hanoflim. So in the darkest month of Teves, which has the darkest, shortest days, the month when the Golus is impending, when we see it looming, the month where we're surrounded, and that's going to mean, Rambam says, constrained. When we're besieged, we're constrained. The month where we see our fall kind of looming ahead of us, that's also the month of hope and the month of support, Somech Hashem. Now we said, this month is associated with Golus. Golus is associated with a pit. The pit that Yosef fell into. We just brought a pasuk. Yosef fell into a pit that had snakes and scorpions. Snakes and scorpions represent, as we said, the nature of things in the last Golus. We said they hinder a person's ability to come close to a Kadosh Baruch Hu from two ways, from nachash, chush, temptation, and Akrav, Oker, Ikrim, just working, you know, against the basic fundamental truths. Now, we said that how it relates to this week's Parsha, and we always read this week's Parsha in the month of Teves, is one of the brachos was to Dan at the end of Yaakov's life. Dan is called a Nachash. His son is called Chushim. Now let's talk about Dan and the month of Teves. So Rav Shapiro points out that there is a very, very direct connection between the tribe of Dan and the month of Teves, the Tur. And Aruch Chaim points out that the three festivals, the Moedim, correspond to the three Avos. And the 3 months, because Rosh Chodesh is also called the Moed, the 12 months, Rosh Chodesh is also called the Moed, correspond to the 12 Shvatim. Okay? The last 3 months, the Arizal and the Vilna Gaon, based on, let's say it this way, based on the arrangements of the tribes in their encampment in the desert, explain that in the north were the last three tribes, Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. And those three tribes who dwelled in the north, who traveled last, by the way, they represent the last 3 months, Teves, Shavat, and Adar, Dan being Teves. So, 12 tribes, 12 months. They were grouped around the Aron in 3, 3, 3, and 3. Yehuda was first. Dan was last to travel. Dan represents the last 3 months of the year. Dan, Naphtali, and Asher, which are Dan, Asher, and Naphtali, which represents, as we said, Teves, Shavat, and Adar. So we have Dan and Teves. Now, why is Dan considered, like Teves, the darkest month? Dan is the lowest month of the lowest tribe of Klal Yisrael. There are many references to this. Number one, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu picked somebody to work on the Mishkan, who did we pick to make all the Kalim? Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur Lamate Yehuda. But he also gave him a helper. Who's that? Aliyav ben Achisamach Lamate Dan. Here Chazal say in the Medrash, right, Shmos Rabbah, Ein lecha gadol mishevet Yehuda, ve'ein lecha yirud mishevet Dan. There's nobody lower that descends lower Yored from Shevet Dan, other than Shevet Dan. Shevet Dan descends to the lowest. What do we know about Shevet Dan? Not only were they in the north, which is where the sun is never really bright. You never plant on the north side of your house, right? You never get full sun. It's always the weakest place for the sun to reach. They traveled last. Amalek, therefore, was able to attack Dan, the Nechasholim, the weak ones, the stragglers. It was Shevet Dan that brought an idol out of Mitzrayim. You know what that was called? Pesel Micha. And they set it up near Shiloh. It was the Shevet of Dan that Yeravam felt comfortable enough putting an Egel in, remember? When the two kingdoms divided, the north, the kingdom of Israel, and the south, the kingdom of Yehuda, and Yeravam, right after Shlomo, Rechavam and Yeravam, the king of the 10 tribes, didn't want the 10 tribes going south to Yerushalayim, to the base of Migdash, because what would happen there, by the way, just random miscellaneous question, what would they see? At Hakel, they would see that they would call Klal Yisrael together, and only the king from base David was allowed to sit. But he would have to stand. So it would be clear that he was not as legitimate. So he didn't want anyone going to the base of Migdash. So he set up his own little mini base of Migdash with eagles, golden eagles, one in Dan. And Dan allowed him to do it. Okay? Now, in addition to this, who was the shofet from Dan? And we think of it as very strange, Shimshon, very strange, you know, model for a shofet. Right? You know the story of Shimshon? Very strange model for a shofet, very not what you would expect in a shofet. And it was Shimshon judged Klal Yisrael, but his methods were unusual, obviously. And he ended up with this Delilah, who somehow seduced him into revealing the source of his strength. So they were able to capture him. Remember, cut off his hair. They gouged out his eyes. They disgraced him. They mocked him. They had a big party when they captured him and did this to him. And they all gathered. You know the story of Shimshon. They all gathered in this type of amphitheater that had some kind of pillars holding up the balconies. And Laman Hashem, for the sake of Hashem, not to save his own life, to give up his own life, he said to the lad that was leading him around, lean me on the pillars. And he asked for one more burst of strength. And with that burst of strength, he, you know, dislodged the pillars, I guess, from their foundations, and the whole building came crashing down, and he killed more in his death than in his life. But the point is, although Shimshon surged forward, so to speak, at the end, his life was a strange, almost low form of benefiting Klal Yisrael, living among the Plishtim, married to them, dealing with them, very unusual. And these are all aspects of Shevet Dan. So Dan clearly represents the lowest Shevet in Klal Yisrael, the most prone to slipping away, the one who brought an idol into Eretz Yisrael right straight out of Mitzrayim. The one that Yaakov's worried about, he calls Dan, is a nachash. He's a snake. He gives into his temptation. And he brings down the horse and the rider. And that means the horse and the rider is a noble way of describing a person who's actually overcome and has subdued their physical kind of like drives. And they drive the horse. They ride. They direct. They're in the, you know, in the driver's seat. And he topples that. The snake that comes and topples the rider off the horse. That's done. Now, if you were Shevet, from Shevet Dan, you wouldn't, you know, you'd be a little hopeless. I guess you'd feel somewhat, right? But on the other hand, Dan, it's very interesting, okay? Because Dan is the source of the Yardane. Now, on the one hand, there were miracles that were necessary to cross the Yardane into Eretz Yisrael. Okay? So what that means is that it really, you know, separates Eretz Yisrael from the rest of the world. And it's hard. That boundary is a boundary that is like almost absolute. It needs to be there, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu protects that boundary, and only a miracle will kind of neutralize that boundary and allow there to be movement from outside of Eretz Yisrael to inside of Eretz Yisrael. That's Dan. Dan is Yored Dan. Yored Dan. It comes down from the area of Dan. So on the one hand, Dan is the weakest. On the other hand, there's an aspect to Dan that protects us from outside. Now, there's also something fascinating here that the Shalah points out. Yaakov gives a bracha to Dan. As we know, he calls him a nachash, but he ends the bracha with Liyeshuascha kivisi Hashem. For your salvation, I hope HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because simply, when you are so prone to weakness, to darkness, to falling to the lowest level, what do? You know that there's only one one last resort, one lifeline to hold on to, and that's trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, throwing everything aside and saying, God, I just look towards your salvation because I'm at the bottom of the pit. Okay? But Yaakov said something else also. He said many things, but the Shalah brings down a comparison and a kind of really a interplay between what Yaakov said about the Yardane that comes from Dan eventually. He says, Ki bimakli avarti es hayardane hazeh. Remember that? Only with my staff did I cross this Yardane. This is all in the area of the secrets, more the hidden secrets of what's going on beneath the surface here in the Torah. Now, when Yaakov says, Ki bimakli avarti es hayardane hazeh, talking about Dan, and we said Dan is going to relate to Teves, it's his month, the darkest month. And we haven't spoken about why Teves is so significant. It's truly the beginning of the Gullus, but we can't truly understand it without understanding the eighth of Teves, which we'll get to soon, which is the Septuagint. Now, the Shalah says, the Shnei Luchos Abris, right? The Shalah says, take the two words, Ki Bimakli. Write them out so you see what we're doing here. Take the first four letters of Ki Bimakli, and you have a Chaf, a Yud, a Beis, and a Mem. What does that spell? Unscramble them. Maccabi. That's Maccabi. Take the last three letters, Kuf, Lamed, and Yud. What are they the Rosh HaTevas for? Liyeshuascha kivisi Hashem. That's what he said about Dan. Now, what he's saying here is that we're straddling here two things. The Maccabim, which are interesting, it's Chanukah is a yantav of lights. Teves is the darkest month. Chanukah is a yontiv that spans Kislev and Teves. It's the only chag to do that. Okay? So you have the lights of Kislev, the success of Kislev, the rededication of the Beis HaMikdash of Kislev, leading into the darkness of Teves, shave it, done, in which your only hope is ki li yishuascha ki visi Hashem. And when Yaakov says ki b'makli avarti es hayardin hazeh, what he's trying to say is, with these two aspects, with the fortitude and the drive of the Maccabees and everything we talked about, submission to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, etc., that lights up our year in Kislev, and the darkness and the descent that represents Shevet Dan and Teves, there's one thing that guarantees that we will not be lost, and that is the hope, the prayer, ki lishuascha ki visi Hashem. I can only trust in and hope to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to restore me. Now, we have a concept. Yerida litzorech aliyah. That this is the way the world works. A descent for the purpose of an ascent. Sometimes we say it this way, people have to hit rock bottom before they start climbing up the ladder. Sometimes people have to see, you know, have to get to a point where they become hopeless with themselves. They see that the path they're choosing, the choices they're making are leading them to ultimately to self-destruction. But only when they're there at the bottom of the pit do they begin to find a way or feel the necessity to climb out. And when you want to climb out of a pit that perhaps you dug yourself into, actually, then the only solution is to trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So we have a couple of ideas already swirling around. As we said, we have Dan, all the aspects of the darkness or the lowness or the weakness of Dan. Yet, at the same time, there's hope in that lowness because there's a Yerida for an Aliyah. So Teves, we just said, is the darkest time of all. But what month is Teves in the Hebrew calendar starting from Nisan? Which month? Number? The 10th. And what day is Asar B'Teves? The 10th, 10 and 10. And what does 10 always represent in our, you know, understanding of the numbers? That's a Kaddish Baruch Hu, Yud Yud. That's Ruchnius. That's Olam Haba. That's the future. In other words, it's the darkness, but it's also a glimpse and an encouragement, a sense that through the deep depths you can reach the highest heights. Remember we said this is the day that Samach Melech Bavel. That's a weird way to describe a siege. He surround, like a samach is round, samach means to surround, but we use that word samach to connote someh Hashem l'kol hanoflim. Hashem supports and surrounds in a positive way, as opposed to besieging and surrounding in a negative way for destruction. Hashem supports and surrounds for life, for to encourage, to build a person up. That's what's really happening with Dan and Teves. It's the lowest, it's the darkest, and yet at the same time, it's where the hope resides. It's where you start to build yourself up. But here's the point. Moshe Rabbeinu points this out, a very profound insight. When a person starts to build themselves up, okay, where do they start from? If they're in a pit, and the pit is only filled with nechashim, snakes and scorpions, in other words, my heart leading me around and my mind, you know, befuddling me with, you know, ideas, doubts and disbelief and questions, and I can't seem to attach myself to that you know, lifeline. So what will lift out? What do you have to put into the well to create a buoyancy that everything just rises to the surface and falls out on its own? Water. Water, which is Torah. But let's look at the attack on Torah that took place in Teves, called the Septuagint. Now, you all kind of know what it is. In the time of Talmai II, Philadelphus, which was an inheritor of Alexander the Great's great empire, but which Alexander, you know, was the son of Philip of Macedonia, Yugoslavia area, north of Greece. Alexander the Great conquered the whole known world at the time, and Greek Hellenistic culture came to the world, and it came to Israel. Okay, Alexander the Great died. The empire was divided up. The Ptolemy, spelled with a P, P-T-O-L-M-E-Y, got Egypt, North Africa. They got Israel for a while. Then there were skirmishes with the other half of Alexander's empire, which was given to the Seleucids, and it was actually under the Seleucids that the Hanukkah story happened. Israel was always in between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Anyway, in the time of Ptolemy II, about 250 B.C., after Hanukkah, he decided to, you know, in his quest to create the greatest library that ever existed, he was translating all the important books to to Greece, and this was the famous Library of Alexandria. And he commissioned, as we know, 72 Talmidei Chachamim to translate the Torah into Greek. Septuagint is a translation of the 72. And he put them all in separate rooms, and he said, go. Now, this was a problem. As you know, Torah does not easily lend itself to a Greek-style translation. Now, let's be clear. Torah had been translated already. Moshe Rabbeinu, we know, wrote the Torah in 70 languages. There was something particularly dangerous about translating it into Greek. And Chazal see it as that the Greek language is an extension of Greek wisdom, and how Greek wisdom, although if it's attached to Torah, is the most beautiful thing. If it's not attached to Torah, it's darkness. Now, Greece and darkness go together, which is very strange, because the whole world thinks that Greece is enlightenment. But we clearly relate to it as darkness. For example, in the second pasuk, V'ha'aretz ha'isa tohu v'avohu v'choshech. Tohu, right, is Bavel, and Bohu is Persia, Paris and Mada, and Choshech is Greece. Greece is Choshech to us. So what is so bad about Greek wisdom trying to capture the truth of the Torah? That's really the question, because the Septuagint was considered a calamity. Chazal say 3 days of darkness descended to the world, of which 10th of Teves is one, although Septuagint was 600 years later or more, okay, but still it's in this time period. And it was like the Chet HaEgel, they say. It was as bad as the Chet HaEgel. This was very bleak. This was in Teves. This was has to do with what we're talking about, a descent to the lowest point. It has to do with Asar B'Teves, which is constraint, a siege, negatively understood. Not supportive, but constraint. What is so bad about the Septuagint that Chazal see it as such a calamity? The Torah was translated into Greek, or tried to be grasped by Greek-style wisdom. Something that we all kind of know, but we might not articulate it. Okay? What is Greek wisdom? Aristotle, the father of, mathematics, science, physics, whatever. The Greeks gave us so much. They gave us government, they gave us oratory, they gave us sciences of all sorts, they gave us all kinds of new ideas in the arts, in philosophies, all kinds of things. But when we talk about Western knowledge, okay, as opposed to, let's say, Eastern, this is really where the discomfort comes in, Western style in like Greek Enlightenment. What we're really speaking about, if you want to put your finger on it, is the Greeks introduced like the scientific method, observation, calculation, hypotheses, and the ability to prove the information that you're trying to promote as true, right? Scientific method, equations, mathematics, empirical process, which is you have to show everything and you have to be able to prove it and to then do an experiment and prove it again and make it happen a third time, and then it's true. It's not just a gut feeling. It's not just a supposition that seems to be true. We want everything today has to be proven, whether it's in psychology, it's in mathematics, it's in health and nutrition, in exercise. Everything is tested. There's control groups and test groups, and there's everything is proven and meticulously quantified. Okay, that's what we call Greek wisdom. It's humanity coming to really assert a certain domination over all aspects of nature by understanding how it works, and therefore working within its rules, and therefore utilizing its rules. It's all very good, but when it comes to Torah, there's a problem. That is not the way Torah works. Torah is logical, but there is very little in Torah that is quantifiable. Yes, there are certain rules, halachas, that are absolute. But the reason for the halacha and what it does to you and why you should be so attached to it, it's not quantifiable. First of all, the effects of Torah on each person are different. Depends on the person. There's so much that has to do with your kavana. In scientific method, your kavana doesn't mean anything. It's only what you can prove on the page. It's only what you can see, what you can feel, what you can demonstrate. But that is not how halacha works. That's not how, I would say, not halacha. That's not how real Torah truth works. Right? You can quantify how much tzedakah a person gives, but you cannot quantify whether the person giving $5 is a greater tzaddik than the person giving $5 million. You cannot prove that. That is the kavana of the lave. That's only for Hashem to see. Our whole ruchnius connection is of that nature. It's not something that can be plotted on a graph. It's different for every person. It's different every day for a person. It comes and goes. There are high points and low points. Certain times, things that look terrible are actually catalysts for the greatest growth that are actually good. And even the way the Torah is written, it is not written in a way that is methodical, hold it to the letter of the law. Even, let's say, example, ayin tachas ayin. Chazal don't interpret it that way at all. They say the value of the ayin. You know the Groz little famous insight here, right? With ayin tachas ayin. Take the letters ayin, yud, nun, ayin. And then take tachas ayin, the letters that come right after ayin, yud, and nun. So what's the letter that comes right under or right after ayin? Pei. And the letter that comes right after yud? Kaf. And the letter that comes on right after nun? Samach. What do you get? Kesef. Money. It's the value of the I. So even the way Torah is written, it's not written in a way that you can, kind of set it up in the type of an equation and you know what it is. And also, you don't understand Torah, and you don't even understand how mitzvahs work if you learn about them from the text. You have to experience them. You really can't describe the feeling of Shabbos to someone who's never kept Shabbos. You can't say to them, well, if you don't drive, you'll have 3 degrees of a feeling of ruchnius. But if you don't use hot water or squeeze a sponge, you'll have 7 degrees. It'll be even more, and you'll feel it in, what part of your body do you feel it in, and how many hours do you feel it for? It's not how it works. Much of all of the ruchnius kind of work of a person is experiential, and it's not describable, and it's not really shareable with people, with other people. So Torah, the nature of Torah is not at all like the nature of Greek wisdom. And in its most fundamental value, let's talk about the Egel, because they compare the Septuagint to the Egel. Okay, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu came to Klal Yisrael, he said, do you want the Torah? And they said, Nasa v'nishma, right? And then after that, Hashem put the mountain over their heads. Why? They already said Nasa v'nishma. So the famous idea on this is that it cannot be said that Torah's truths were accepted voluntarily by the people, because it cannot be that Torah is accepted based on the preference or the okay or of human beings whose minds have decided to accept Torah. The Torah is subject to human beings' desire to have Torah because they feel it's understandable or they want to attach themselves to it. In other words, it's not something that human beings bring to the world based on their own sense of admiration for it. So therefore they accept it. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to put the mountain on their heads to prove that Torah is muchrach, it's truth, it must exist. It cannot be subject to the preference of the people. Although the people accepted the Torah, which is a great, great, madrega for Klal Yisrael, and vis-a-vis the Torah itself, it cannot be something that we chose to accept, because then it's subject to our appreciation of it. Greek wisdom is exactly that. We choose to accept the conclusions of our experimentation or our work if they make sense to us. That's how Greek, style learning works, Western style. It's exactly the opposite of the Torah. The Torah is that it is truth, whether you understand it or not, so just go with it, and the truth will reveal itself in time to you. The more you keep the mitzvahs, the more you'll understand their value. The more you live the life, the more it will fill you with satisfaction. But you have to start it with emunah, start with trust, And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu will repay you with a sense of the awe that we always speak about, the light, the warmth, and the clarity, and the comfort of the light of Torah that will come to you once you already accept it. It's the exact opposite. What was the Cheder Egel? They wanted something they could see. It's a simple pshat. Something quantifiable, something that they could go, a place that they could go to with an object they could see that they could address their prayers to. They wanted to reduce it to something that, you know, had a specific form and shape. Same concept. The Torah is not of that nature. So now talk about the Septuagint. They said it was darkness for the world because the nature of Torah is not like that at all. And that's really where the darkness comes to us in Golos. Because he surrounded Yerushalayim, which means he constrained, same concept, to try to restrain the Torah into its words, into its technical laws, and that's the whole Torah, and that's what it is to destroy it. It isn't the words and the actual particulars of it. It's a whole lifestyle that comes along with the person. The person contributes to it, works with it, lives in it, and exists, you know, and grows and blossoms. It's the same concept, the Septuagint limiting it in description, in understanding, him constraining the city in a siege. But look what happens in Golos. For the first time, Klal Yisrael realize that they are not going to be independent and autonomous and in their own land. They're actually going to be subsumed among the nations. And when the nations look at us and our lifestyle and our mitzvahs, it's not something you understand on the surface. Why do you do these things? Why do you do chukim? They make no sense. Why does it matter where you slaughter the animal, here or here? Why don't you put wool and linen together? Why do you, the Chazal say you can't ride a horse because you might break off a branch, and you're not allowed to break off a branch on Shabbos. Well, what if I'm riding a horse where there's no trees? Okay, right? It doesn't make sense. But we have other principles. And we understand that there's something called, that Chazal set up things that are just not in the spirit of Shabbos. We have all kinds of ideas that to live them is to really appreciate them. One of the classic ones is the role of the Jewish woman, by the way. From the outside, like Nebuch, you know, we can't be called up to the Torah, and we can't be a chazin, and we're so, you know, therefore we're so limited and disrespected. But if you know the other halachos, and you see how the Torah writes, and you live according to the Torah law, it's not like that at all. And we don't really care about the fact that we can't be a chazan. And for most people, it doesn't limit their spiritual ability to attain, you know, a sense of closeness or to play an important role. The actual living it, you recognize that it's not, you know, what it sounds like if you just wrote it all out in paper. So this is the nature of Torah. And so this is how it's so different from trying to kind of limit it to just the words that could be understood or the way it's understood in according to Western science. Now, when we go into Golos, this is one of the ways where Klal Yisrael find that they could fall, like done, to the bottom. Because the attacks from the nations around us are specifically this: defend your Torah. Defend your Torah. Defend the laws in the Torah. Defend the philosophies in the Torah. Now, one of the things we often, and we spoke about this a few months ago, feel like we need to defend, right, is how Hashem conducts the world. Because again, unlike Greek wisdom, where you things are true if they make sense and they're equitable, so we think that we have to also kind of prove that, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu conducts the world in a way that also makes sense and balances out. So remember what happened with Eov? So what happened with Eov is that he was innocent and he was suffering. And his friend said to him, it must be that you sinned, because sin equals suffering. And that's a balanced equation. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu would never cause you to suffer for no reason, so you must have sinned. It must be balanced, because that's what the mind wants to accept. So what did Eov answer? He insisted. Mm-hmm. I'm innocent. I have not sinned. I am not guilty. It is not the cause. I don't understand why Hashem is doing this. It needs a justification. And I'm not guilty. I didn't sin. In the end of the whole thing, HaKadosh Baruch Hu came and spoke to Eov's friends. And he told them, you're guilty, especially Eliphaz, you're guilty for two reasons. Number one, you accused an innocent man of being a sinner. And you didn't trust him that when he said he was not a sinner. Who are you to accuse an innocent man of being a sinner? You're not allowed to do that. Now, why did you accuse an innocent man of being a sinner? Why did you go down this path and torment him? Where did this come from? Why did you feel you had to do this? Because you were trying to defend me. You don't have to defend me. You were trying to say, well, I don't want to say that Hashem is unjust, so I have to say Eov sinned. You don't have to say either of them. Eov didn't sin. There is something called the suffering of the innocent, which we've spoken about. And you don't have to defend the Kadosh Baruch Hu, because you don't have to understand the way Hashem conducts the world. You just have to know that Hashem does conduct the world. Now, this is not a talk on suffering of the innocent. That's for another, we've done it, and it's for another, maybe we'll do it again one day. But the point here is, this type of wisdom, that our mind doesn't have to understand the things we're doing, and doesn't have to understand all the words in the Torah until they reveal themselves on their own. Okay, that's the type, that's the wisdom of the Torah. I just want to give you a few examples of Torah truths that reveal themselves eventually, but we attach ourselves to them and we are committed to them even though we don't necessarily understand what they're about. So in halacha, we have shatnas. Nobody knows why wool and linen is something detrimental, dangerous. We can't put it on our bodies. But it happens to be interesting that in the whole space program, they finally concluded, and they seems to be that this is what they use, the material they use, that for insulation purposes, so the spaceships don't burn up on their re-entry into Earth as they go through the atmosphere, they insulate them with some form of shatness. Who knows what this means? It's a wool-linen combination that protects them. But here's something even more astonishing that was just in the news about 2 to 3 weeks ago. Okay, you might have heard about this. You know, for example, there were nevuos that Hashem will bring us in the future to Eretz Yisrael, al kanfei nesharim, right? You know, now how could people have understood what that meant on the wings of eagles? Now it's like obvious, right? Airplanes. Okay, certain things are sitting in the Torah, but they don't make sense in a quantifiable, you know, provable kind of way. How are people going to sit on the wings of an airplane? So the whole Torah is just silly fairy tales, like, you know, Hans Christian, what's his name? Hans Christian Andersen, right? Okay, I'll tell you later when this is off. But here's something unbelievable, okay? It says in Hazinu that in the end of days, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to bring Klal Yisrael back to Eretz Yisrael. And he's going to satiate them with you know, all kinds of descriptions and with, you know, with wine and this. And it says there, Hashem will at that point satiate Klal Yisrael with shemen mechalamish tzur, with oil from a flinty rock. He will satiate Klal Yisrael. Okay. Remember Howard Jonas and IDT?
Yes.
Okay. So he did great, and he hired everybody who walked through the door, and everybody made a lot of money, and then the company went kaput, correct? And he fired everybody, and his stocks went down to 30 cents on the dollar, instead of whatever it was, 30 cents, right? Okay, now, you haven't heard so much about IDT, okay? What has he been involved in? This just hit the papers a few weeks ago. He's leased huge swaths of land in the Midwest, because America has the largest shale field in the world. Now, what is shale? It's a flaky, flinty rock that you can get oil out of, and more oil than Saudi Arabia. Guess who has the second largest shale fields in the world? Eretz Yisrael. Now, everybody knew about shale, except the technology was not economical. It was way too expensive to extract the oil from the shale. However, he has announced that he has found an economical way to extract the oil from the shale, okay? He has huge investors lining up, the biggest, okay? And all the biggest names are, you know, part of this project. And he hopes by, I don't know what year, within 10 years or something, he will be producing oil. Now, if Eretz Yisrael has an oil reserve larger than Saudi Arabia, okay, I think it's a game changer, okay? Also America. Okay? Just think about the implications of this. By the way, the Arabs, you know, they had this black gold bubbling up from the ground. They sold it and they built ski slopes in the desert, indoor ski slopes. You've seen all that, right? Islands in the shapes. You've seen what they've done in Dubai and everywhere. Just go online. It's unbelievable. But they never figured out how to build any technology, how to make a medication. They don't build cars. In other words, they don't produce anything the world needs other than oil. So when we don't need their oil anymore, They could use it to fill their swimming pools. But the point is, they are irrelevant, and the threats that they, you know, present to the world, we don't have to be afraid of them anymore. It says in Hazinu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take shemen mechalamish tzur in the end of days for Klal Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael. Oil from a flinty rock. Shale is clearly a flinty rock. It's that rock that kind of, you know, kind of lay it chips off. Who knows what this means? So if you evaluate the Torah, you know, prematurely, before the nevuahs have come true, if you evaluate the halacha before you understand what their benefits of them are, which we don't understand necessarily in a tangible way, you don't understand that it can't be limited. So to put this all together, what we have here is that although Asar B'Teves is the darkest, it is also 10-10. It's also Ruchnius and Ruchnius. In other words, from the lowest place, we reach out to our Kodesh Baruch Hu. One of the low places are when our entire Torah is under assault because it's not understandable in the world we live in. It doesn't work with the same rules. It can't be subjected to the same tests. And therefore, it's under attack all the time. That's a low point because that causes Jewish people alone to start feeling like the Torah doesn't make any sense, the laws don't make any sense, the whole thing is written in a way that doesn't make sense. Maybe the whole thing, you know, and we fall to a low point, and that encourages people to, you know, to give it up, to feel distant from the Torah. And that's the notion of dan, to feel very distant, to feel separated from the Torah. But Yaakov ends the words, he says, "B'lishuascha kivisi Hashem." That in this state of being, in the last gullus, at the last time, at the darkest point, just trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You don't have to defend HaKadosh Baruch Hu like you taught Eov's friends. Sometimes you don't have to explain, you know, you can't explain. Leave it alone. We don't expect to be able to explain everything to everybody. We just persevere on our path, our attachment, our knowledge of what's true, our holding on to the future that's looming right ahead of us. And that's it. We hold on to what we know is right because we have to preserve our personal attachment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, our family, our community. And if we can't explain it perfectly and we can't, you know, stand and hold our heads up high because people can make all kinds of fun of it or put it down, that's just how it is. And yet we keep our faith, we keep our trust that it'll all come to clarify itself in a great hour where the dark days of Teves will eventually become the light days, the clearest days, and we'll have learned the lesson of the Shevet Dan, that when you're at the bottom, there's only one way to go, is to go up. And the Dan represents for us the surge of attachment that, you know, if there's only one way, and there's only up, and from the lowest point, you know, there aren't really any options, and Dan, therefore, you know, establishes us really hope. Really hope. Lishuascha kivisi, the hope of the dark, you know, through the darkness. Okay, everybody. Oh, I wanted to tell you, first of all, thank you all for the Hanukkah gift. It was very, very generous and will be put to very good use. And you notice this beautiful necklace that was last year's Hanukkah gift, which I get tons of compliments on. I appreciate it. And thirdly, before you end, there is a production by the Neshei Tzedakah Players, all homegrown talent to benefit Rachel's house or Rachel's place. It's a play. They're putting it on three times. It's Tzedakah, and it should be very entertaining if you want to take the flyers. And Monday at 9:15, and one more thing after that, we are starting. Oh, and one more thing. Monday at 9:15, we're starting at Tehillim Chabura this coming Monday. Place to be announced for Tzedakah for Kesher Yehudi. Rivka Fuchs is in charge. See her. Small, interactive learning, you know, of Tehillim. Not just reciting Tehillim, learning. Also, today's learning is the Refuah Shalema from Miriam Rochel Bas Chana. And also, January 6th, I'm not going to be here. And whoever is not on the email in the office, put your name on the office email so you'll know if there's cancellations or whatever. Okay, everyone, have a good week.